Welcome to the Global Connection, a Tel Aviv University podcast. Journey with us as we discover how TAU's academic community and friends are engaging with and helping to shape this ever-changing world.
So good morning, everyone. My name is Professor Ben Maoz, and today we're going to host Netta Fivish and Emma Glickman, that are actually students in our lab. And we're going to talk a little bit about the world of biomedicine and how our lab and Tel Aviv University actually engage in this field and the outcome of the research that we do. So good morning, Netta.
Morning.
Good morning, Emma.
Good morning.
So let's start by talking a little bit about you and why you decided to come here to Tel Aviv and a little bit about your background. So let's start with Emma. So Emma, good morning.
Morning.
Let's hear a little bit about your background. Where are you from? Your degrees?
So I'm from Seattle, and I did my undergraduate degrees in biomaterials engineering and chemistry at Alfred University in a very small town in New York. And I came to Tel Aviv a year and a half ago now, and I made Aliyah and started at Ben's lab in my second degree.
Yes, it's definitely interesting period since you came. Mm-hmm. And Netta?
So I was born in Israel and I moved to the UK when I was 3. And then I did my bachelor's at the University of Birmingham in biomedical sciences and my master's at Imperial College London in neuroscience. And I moved back to Israel about a year and a half ago as well.
Nice. And what made you to do this move, going from London here to Israel?
So after my bachelor's, I did the TAU Summer International Program, where you come to Israel for 2 months and you join a lab. And I did the program at the lab and I saw that the environment at the university was really nice and really friendly, and the science was at a very good level. And I went back to the UK to do my master's, thinking that maybe I'd want to come back here to do my PhD. And then I started to look closer at different labs to see which lab does research that I'm interested in. And one thing led to another and I came back.
How different is the research or the environment, the academic environment here compared to what you experience until now?
It's very different in the sense that you work with friends, not necessarily colleagues. And it's a very friendly and approachable environment. I can knock on your door or my other supervisor's door and have a meeting spontaneously anytime. If I have a question, I don't have to email 1 week in advance to set a formal meeting. So in that sense, it's really nice because you can always get advice and guidance when you need it. And also just the general environment in the lab, we do things together as a lab. It's just a very friendly, warm environment.
Warm by all means, even the weather. Compared to Seattle, upstate New York, or London. Mm-hmm. And Emma, so what suddenly made you to do this move of going here to Israel from upstate New York?
So I knew I had wanted to make Aliyah for a long time, and I had thought that it would be after grad school. But just in reviewing my offers for schools in the US and my offer from Ben, Tel Aviv seemed like a much better option. And I also came and did the summer program, but right before I started my master's. And it was a really nice kind of trial couple of months to get to know everyone in the lab, understand the dynamic in the lab, and get started in the research without the pressure of immediately hopping into a master's. And like Netta said, it's a very friendly, nice environment, which I also had in my first degree, but at a very, very small university. And it was really nice to see that translate to a much bigger, better funded research community.
And you don't have a background in biology or biomedicine, right?
To some extent, like within the degree of biomaterials engineering, I learned like basic biology, but I never worked with human cells or really any kind of tissue engineering until I came to your lab.
So what are you doing these days? What is your main project?
I am working on understanding the relationship between chronic high glucose levels and the development of Alzheimer's. And we're doing that by building kind of a brain on a chip. I'm working with all human cells, and we're putting together like a mini organ on a chip to study this relationship between the high glucose and neurodegeneration.
So just to clarify, for those who are not familiar with the term on a chip, we're not doing like electronic chip.
No.
We're doing something that is more related to tissue engineering, that where we're actually trying to tackle the challenge that between 60 to 90% of the drugs that actually pass animal trials fail in human clinical trials. So we're trying to move from animal models and to do it with human tissues. And we're creating, as you mentioned, we're trying to mimic or recapitulate the organ functionality inside this. We call it a chip, but it's basically, it looks like a Lego plastic thing that enables us to mimic one organ in this chip and a different organ in a chip. And then basically we can link them together to create this multi mini organ that can mimic and recapitulate organ-organ interaction and things like this. So this is just to clarify the terminology. Let's switch now into the British one. So Netta, what are you doing in your current research?
So I'm doing a very molecular project on Parkinson's disease, which combines a lot of biochemistry and also some of the tools that we talked about in order to study RNA dynamics in Parkinson's disease. So specifically, why the expression of certain proteins linked to Parkinson's disease cause neurodegeneration, and what happens to the cell at the mechanistic level when you have expression of these proteins. Yes, and I'm doing this using all sorts of very cutting-edge tools, including super-resolution microscopy, which is basically when you can look at proteins at a ridiculous resolution, approximately 20 nanometers, which for non-biologists is a very, very high resolution. And also recently I've started to work with human cells, which is exciting because it has better physiological relevance. And
So I would like to take a step back, because both of you all the time say that you work on a project related to the brain and you work with nerve cells and things like this. But how can you actually take cells that are related to the brain that are human relevant? So
we take a type of cells called induced pluripotent stem cells. You take a sample, like a skin sample from a person, and then give it a bunch of different chemical factors to have it kind of de-differentiate into a stem cell that can then, given the right growth factors, become pretty much any other kind of cell. So what I'm currently working on is taking a stem cell of a particular genetic line and changing its DNA a little bit so that it can pretty easily differentiate into a neuron. So then I have a human neuron from one particular genetic line, and I can look at how this person's genetics can respond to this high glucose. And eventually we will do all the other cells in the brain from that same genetic line. So we'll have on a chip a miniature human brain with cells all from the same person.
So basically, just to make it more general in that sense, if we want to take cells from a human, so we can do it in multiple ways, right? We can take a biopsy, and then we can work with we call it primary or primary cells that we take it directly from the human. Usually if we work with brain, we don't want to do it. If we want to work with skin or blood or fat even, we can do it relatively easy. But it's not the case when we want to work with Parkinson, like Netta said, or brain like Emma said. So to overcome this challenge, as you mentioned, we try to work with these cutting edge tools that allows us to take cells that are not neurons and somehow to induce them to be neurons. To make it easier to understand, we need to remember how people come to the world. So we all know that you have the sperm, you have the egg, they ovulate, then we have this blastocyte that is basically a ball of stem cells. And these stem cells get these different factors, as you mentioned, to become a bone, a brain, a heart, a muscle, whatever. And we all know for many years that once it was differentiated, it became a bone, so it will not be a brain. And when you have a brain cell, it will not be a heart. And this was changed. This dogma was changed about 12 years ago by Professor Shinya Yamanaka in Japan, and he received the Nobel Prize for this. That actually what you can do, as Emma mentioned, you can take a cell from your skin, make it a stem cell, and then once it's a stem cell, you can give similar factors that will mimic the embryonic development to a specific tissue that you would like to do. And this is basically what you do in the lab in this sense. So going back to you, Netta, you said also that you're moving to human tissues in that sense. So, and you're trying to mimic Parkinson in the lab, actually in a dish, in vitro. So how you mimic Parkinson in a dish?
So there's various different ways you can do this. So one way, which isn't what I'm doing, but it's something that other people in the lab do, is you can take cells from patients with Parkinson's disease, which have specific genetic mutations, which are linked to Parkinson's disease. And then you can reprogram the cells and differentiate them into neurons or whichever other cell type you're interested in studying. So that's one way. And the way that I do is that I form neurons, not necessarily with any mutations which have Parkinson's, at the stage where I'm differentiating. And then I can transduce them or infect them with genetically modifying viruses, which can introduce mutations into the cells themselves. So that's what I'm currently doing. We have a virus which has a mutation that's linked to Parkinson's disease, which causes the overexpression of a protein we're interested in. And we can infect the cells. And then we have aggregation of these proteins, which cause Parkinson's disease in vitro.
So do you people know the mechanism for Parkinson, actually? Or there is a specific phenotype? Or how does it go when you want to mimic this in the dish?
So that's the kind of the issue. There's a lot that we still don't know. It's unclear what the precise mechanism is, but there has been a lot of development. So we do know which proteins are linked to it and which genes, which common mutations can cause Parkinson's disease or increase the risk for Parkinson's disease. So we can work with some of these proteins in order to try and mimic aspects of the disease.
Now, both of you mentioned that the lab is very interdisciplinary in that sense. How does it reflect your daily life in the lab, that the fact it's so interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary or this kind of thing, how it is actually affecting slash reflecting your work?
I think for me, it's really interesting because I come from more of an engineering background and I came to the lab with almost no experience in biology, in like working with tissues. So I have the engineering side of things, and I was taught the biology and tissue engineering side of things by people in the lab who have been, through their careers, much more focused on biology and tissue engineering. And it's kind of like everyone in the lab has a specialty, and I know who I can go to for help with any type of problem. Like, there are people that I go to for problems with tissue engineering, there are people that I go to for problems with like a specific 3D printer, and then I'm the person that people come to for problems with some engineering aspects and some of the 3D printers. So it's nice that we have this very expansive experience in the lab, because there's always someone who knows a little bit more than you do, and you can always find someone to go to for help.
For me, this conversation is very enriching. I didn't know we have problems in the lab. It's already something I didn't know.
Maybe it's personal problems.
Yeah. And how do you see, you know, the fact that it's so interdisciplinary, how it relates to your research, how it affects your research?
So beyond what Emma said, which is obviously the fact that you have different people to go to, which are have experience and in different aspects.
Sorry for interrupting, but for you it's even more extreme because you have two advisors, right? Like, one advisor is a hardcore neurophysiologist and the other one is in biomedical engineering. So for you it's even more extreme that you have two labs that are very different, right?
I like it because in one lab I can focus purely, you could say, on the neuroscience, the physiology, the biochemistry, and in the other lab it's an opportunity to focus a little bit more on the platform development and the tools and how to really take advantage of the tools that we have in order to research in more cutting edge, more physiologically relevant models. And beyond the fact that it helps my research, I also think it makes the day-to-day more interesting, mm-hmm. because I feel like when you continue with academia, you begin to know more and more about less and less.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a way to continue to hear about different fields of research, because we have somebody in the lab who works on skin and another person who works on the heart, and then people who work on different neurological diseases. And I just think it makes my day-to-day more interesting, which is also very significant when you commit to 10 years at least of academia.
Yeah. Well, no doubt in that sense. And, you know, I definitely support this concept of being so diverse. You know, at the end of the day, it's the way also I direct our lab, to be so multidisciplinary. This is why we have people like Kesha, that she was, you know, psychology and biology. We had people from electrical engineering, like Ophir. We have people from biomedical engineering, from Segal School of Neuroscience, from biology, from material science. So our lab is very, very multidisciplinary, because I really believe in synergy. That, as Emma, you mentioned at the beginning, right, that the fact that someone is really, you know, biologist, and you have another one that is really knowing signal processing, it's really complementary. So instead of having many people that are exactly from the same background, it creates a lot of creativity at the end of the day. So obviously it is something I believe in, but I also believe that this is how science is actually working today. You cannot do a project if you're not trying to engage and to basically pull other technologies, topics, know-how, expertise from different fields. I would like to ask you, you know, we're all the time talking about, okay, we do this really cool science that we can either do organs on a chip, or we can do super resolution microscopy to treat Parkinson, or to see how glucose is actually affecting neurodegeneration. We use IPS technology, organ on a chip technology, and we're trying really to tackle cutting edge or really dire issues in that sense. But what are the challenges? Let's ask, what are the, let's say, first of all, the you feel that the scientific challenges, not necessarily financial challenges or equipment challenges, but more the scientific challenges. And also, what would you say, someone that is not familiar with Israel and the Israeli culture and things like this from all over the world, what would you say they need to be to take into account?
Scientific challenges to start. To start off with, I really enjoy working with iPSCs, with stem cells. But as anyone who has worked with them knows, they are very sensitive. And one little wrong movement or a couple extra hours in old media can be enough to set them off to do something strange.
I will stop you over here for a second, because for those who are really not from the biology world, mm-hmm. So when you mean to work with these stem cells, you mean that you have basically cells that they live happily in a petri dish, mm-hmm. and it is full with the growth factors and the soup that support mm-hmm. their happy life. And at the end of the day, what you need to do is you need to work with them. Right, you need to change the medium, the soup, you need to add different factors. And if you are not doing it in the specific hours, and if you do it too fast or too slow, then spontaneously they start to do whatever they want.
Yes. Okay.
So, and it can be very, very frustrating, mm-hmm. both for you, because you work on it for a really long time. If you, for example, had astrocytes mm-hmm. that were supposed to be ready and someone somehow did something that doesn't work. No, I'm kidding. So it can be really frustrating. But from the other hand, you have this satisfaction that when it is working, you can do whatever you want with the cells.
Yes,
okay,
yes.
So yeah. One of the challenges.
Mm-hmm. And I think the only other major scientific challenge is that it is a big time commitment. Like yeah. with the stem cells in particular, they require attention every single day. They don't care if it's the weekend, they don't yeah. care if it's nighttime, they require attention.
Yeah.
But because the lab has moved pretty much entirely to working with these stem cells, we can kind of take turns of who's coming in on off hours. Yeah. So it's not like I have the entire burden or Netta has the entire yeah. burden. We're working together as a team, which is yeah. really, really nice.
It's important to mention also that it is not something that anyone is obliging you mm-hmm. like to come here off hours or weekends or whatever. It's mm-hmm. basically the science and the cells, they basically dictate the rhythm of work.
Yes.
And it's not something that all the time your PI is saying you come here, come do it now. It's something that comes from the science mm-hmm. and not from the work culture mm-hmm. that we have here.
Yes. Okay. And it does signal to me, like, because I'm not frustrated to be here on off hours, it signals to me how excited I am about the research and how involved I like to be. I don't always like to use other people to take over on the weekends. I like to be the one doing it myself. But it's nice to have the option to kind of balance out the workload. And then being an international student in Israel, also a challenge, but one that I'm enjoying so far.
Do you know Hebrew, by the way?
It's coming slowly. That is one of the big difficulties, being here not speaking Hebrew fluently. Like, I am learning it, but it's a slow process. And it's difficult to communicate. Like, the bureaucracy in Israel is very complicated. There's not a lot of English speakers in the government, or if there are, they don't always want to speak English with you. But another great thing about working in a very, like, friendly lab is that if I have a problem and I need a Hebrew speaker to help me, everyone is available, no matter what. Like, I can text Netta on a Tuesday night and say, I need you to call such and such bureaucratic office and help me. She'll do it in an instant. I think pretty much every bureaucratic issue I've had in this country, someone in the lab has resolved it for me, with me, pretending to be me on the phone. So it's hard to move to a foreign country and to be far away from home and in a place where your native language is not the native language, but the culture in Israel and the culture in the lab in particular is very supportive, and there's always someone to help me figure out whatever I need assistance with.
Nice. And Netta, so what is your take on the scientific challenges and
there's a lot of cultural challenges. Scientific challenges. I guess the thing is, because this technology is so new and a lot of the research that's been done so far is based on animal models, it often requires a lot of calibration to actually get things to work with the models that we want to use. So, for example, with the genetically modifying viruses that I'm using, we previously used them on mouse neurons, and now I'm trying to calibrate them in order to make sure that they do what we want them to do on the human neurons. So this takes a little bit of time, and something that's straightforward in animal models might not be as straightforward in the human cells. So it's a lot of calibration. So you spend a lot of time building your platform and calibrating the platform, and then you spend about 10% of the time actually using these tools to research what you're interested in. But that's just biology.
I agree, but I don't forget the fact that you also need to give your point of view on the cultural challenges in that sense, although your background is a little bit different, that your parents are Israelis and you know how to speak Hebrew. But still, I would like to hear them. I would like to just say a small comment about research in general in that sense, that I think that the major outcome of doing a master degree or a PhD degree is that you learn how to do research. It's not necessarily that you become the expert in the field and you will be the number one in the field, because you cannot. You know, it's like 2 years program, 4 years program. There are people that this is what they do their whole career. However, when you do a master's, and it's much more extreme in a PhD, you learn how to tackle a scientific problem. You know now that what you did in the last year, you got a lot of experience to say, oh, I know this is how the platform is working. This is what I need to do for calibration. This is what I need to do for the analysis. This is the softwares I need to do. And then you know already the limitations of a specific platform for specific questions. And now if now you want to try to tackle a different question, you already know how you build the experimental design, how you build the different tools you will tackle, you know the timeline. It really helps you how to learn how to think scientifically, to go to research papers and to see what other people have done in the field. And I think therefore that the research that you do is not only on the specific question that you do, but it gives you the broader view on how to tackle a scientific question. So this is just a zoom out of, because both of you are obviously frustrated from the challenges you have, but also see how much you learn in the process, because you learn much more sometimes from what is actually failing than actually what is succeeding. Mm-hmm. So what are the main cultural challenges that you experienced so far?
The main cultural challenges. Well, it's quite a turbulent place to live for many different reasons, which we don't need to go into. But I think, yeah, you have to be mentally equipped to deal with the fact that at times it's a bit more stressful to be here than other places. And also naturally it's difficult to be away from your parents and your friends who you've grown up with and you've had for years and years. Moving country, it's a very character building opportunity because all of a sudden you enter into adult life. You're not necessarily, well, when you come to a lab you are in some sort of frame, but it's not like going to school or going to courses where you have seminars and you instantly meet people and are integrated into some sort of group. You have to really invest in creating a life for yourself and someone new.
I think I would like to continue on this point, actually, that I think that, you know, it is somehow also, I think, integrated in the Israeli culture by the fact that, you know, here people are also happy to take you into their, let's say, social life. You become really part of their family in that sense. That is something that I don't want to say less common in other places, but here it's definitely enhanced. But something also that I think is also very different is the age difference, right? Mm-hmm. Because in Israel, you finish high school, usually go to the army for a few years, and then you take a year off somewhere, you know, to clear your mind a little bit, and then you prepare to go to the university. So basically, if you start a bachelor degree, it means that you started already at the age of, let's say, 23, 24, when you just start the bachelor degree, right? It depends if you are male or female, because the military service is different between the males and females. But let's say, give or take the age of 23, you start your bachelor degree. Now, when you finished your bachelor degree, Emma?
I was 21.
21, mm-hmm. Right? So when you came here and you started your master, you basically were younger than most of the people that actually start their bachelor, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Aneta?
Yeah, so I started my PhD when I was 22.
Right.
Yeah.
So age-wise also there is a difference in that sense. And also I think that also the type of let's say the how people are more mature in that sense, because it's not the right word. You can help me with the word.
It's just a different kind of like social system.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. That how was to integrate with it? It was relatively easy, or you felt really
it was definitely odd at first, especially like I specifically think of when I teach on campus. I teach a lab course, one of Ben's courses. And most of the students that I'm teaching who are in their first degrees are older than I am. And Nanta also teaches this course. They're older than her as well. And it's really weird to think that, like, I have finished my first degree, I'm on my second degree, I've moved countries, like, and these people are partway through their first degrees. It's just a very different mindset. I don't think it's a difference in maturity. It's just a different... It's shifted. Everything is shifted. But it's...
Do you feel it in your daily life? Like, you... Is it...
I think... Yes, but it's like, it's kind of like in the US, everyone that's my age is basically in the same point as in life as I am. And here, there's a lot more variance. Like, there could be someone who's 30 who's in their master's, or someone who's 22 and in their master's. Like, there's a much broader range of who is at what point in life. And it's made me realize that I can be friends with people in a very wide range of ages, and it's more about like what kind of life experience a person has had rather than like how old they are. And that's very different from the US, I think.
Aneta?
Yeah, so you do feel it because people are at different life stages from you. So sometimes at lunch in my other lab, they like to talk about their children and giving birth. And I have nothing to contribute to the conversation beyond getting stressed out about giving birth. But I also feel like, yeah, it is a maturing experience because you learn to be friends with people from different ages. And also in the lab, there are people who are closer in age to you. So Emma and I immediately connected, mm-hmm. not only because we both made Aliyah, but also because we're in similar in age and we like to do the same things on our off time.
But you also have, Israeli friends, right? Mm-hmm. People that are not only came from abroad.
100%, right? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So basically, to summarize in one sentence, what we talked about is that definitely both of you did a shift in life, both work-wise, research topic, country-wise, culture-wise, and you know, it's definitely not where you started. And also in the past years, definitely you experienced quite a bit, both professionally and also, you know, to live in this exotic place. And both of you actually decided to stay, right? So I guess it was not that bad after all. But what would you say, like, to people that hear us from this podcast on, you know, related to the Tel Aviv University International School, what would you recommend / say from your experience about what is going on here, you know, as a take-home message?
I think... like, from my experience specifically, the research has been fantastic. The level of science that we're doing is incredible. The funding level is incredible. And I have a lot of freedom to do what I'm interested within the bounds of my project. And that's really, really nice. And that's not necessarily something that I had experienced in my first degree. And socially, and with the current situation here, everyone has been very, very supportive. I stayed in the country since October, and every day someone from the lab was checking in and making sure that I felt okay. And still now everyone is just aware that it's difficult to be here and far away from family during such a difficult time. And I really feel like a very high level of support from the people that I work with. And it's very comforting to know that I have that here.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Netta?
My take-home message is that I'm happy I moved. Because beyond the fact that it's really character building and I just really enjoy being in Israel for all sorts of reasons, the weather, the people, the environment at the university. I love the university here, just coming in every day. The campus is really nice and the people are really friendly. So the past few months have made me appreciate being in Israel, actually, beyond being anywhere else, because everybody here understands what you're going through, is in a similar mentality. It's very supportive. And I feel like it's times like this which actually bring you closer to the people around you. So... yeah, so there's a silver lining.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, it's actually really, it's warm my heart to hear, you know, the feelings that you have in such a unique environment and not typical, let's say, time. You know, I would like to thank both of you, Emma Glickman and Netta Fibish, about, you know, taking your time and coming here. And I hope that we were able to give a little bit of taste and flavor about, you know, the research that we do, at least in our lab. And if people that listen to this podcast actually want to learn a little bit more, obviously they can go to our website of the Maoz Lab. They can contact us, they can contact you, and to listen and get more information about the research that we do and about the research opportunity that there is in the Tau International Master Program, and there is the Tau International Summer School, Summer Program, two different programs, but a lot of fun. And we hope that that we will meet again in the podcast, that we will be able to enrich more about the things and the research that we do. So thank you very much, both of you. And for the people who listen, I hope they will have a great day.